For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy, and we will be joined in a little bit by South Carolina coach Mark Kingston, who will let us know about the Gamecocks as we creep ever closer to the 2021 college baseball season. But before we get to all of that, I've got to let you know that the Baseball America College Podcast is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, it's Christmas week. We want to wish all of our listeners happy holidays. Hopefully everyone is able to, have a nice holiday season here coming up. It's going to be a different one, assuredly, but we wanted to keep the podcast coming because, I know that just because it's the holidays doesn't mean that you don't have time to kill or drives to make, dogs to walk, dishes to wash. I don't know, whenever you listen to podcasts, those are all examples of when I listen to the podcast. So I assume all of you are doing similar things here. And while you're at it, don't forget to subscribe. If you are not subscribed to the Baseball America College Podcast, you can do so on your favorite podcasting app, Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you're finding the podcast, you can subscribe. But Joe, it's a holiday season, and I'm told you have an update for all of our listeners that have been with us throughout the fall about your trash can situation.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to bring our listeners up to speed on what I'm calling Trash Can Gate, although I wish I had a better name for it. I feel like we overuse the Watergate naming convention for different controversies in our life. I think Deflategate is what really kind of jumped the shark on things being, blank gate, whatever. So anyway, listeners who listen to us regularly will remember a couple of weeks ago, I told the story of I came back from being gone a couple of days and, a little more than a couple of days, but being gone and trash can was just gone. I'd set it out because I didn't want bags of trash sitting in my trash can the entirety of time I was gone, and figured, yes, our HOA doesn't like you to leave your trash cans out for a lengthy period of time, but I figured, it's a holiday week. This was Thanksgiving week. It'll be okay for this one time. I told some of my neighbors about it. I told, people around just so they could kind of keep an eye on it. Well, lo and behold, I come home, trash can is gone. Now, the first thing that very quickly happened is, I talked to the people that live closest to me, and they said, oh no, I'm not sure. We certainly don't have it. But I'm not sure exactly what happened. We didn't see anybody take it. So that was a dead end. So I just, after a few days, I called the city of Durham out here, and they were very accommodating. They were like, yeah, man, it just happens. The theory they had was, which I did not buy at the time, but I have no reason to not just believe this is true in general, but they say sometimes they use the automated trash truck, to lift the can up over the truck, and they say sometimes the can will just fall in as a malfunction. And that was their theory on what happened. I was like, I don't know. Just seems too weird that it happened while it had been sitting out for a long, long time. That would be quite a coincidence. So, but moral of the story, they say, no problem, we'll bring you a new trash can. So your boy has a brand new City of Durham trash can. The one I had was, frankly, I'd had started having a debate on, like, do I call them and tell them I need a new trash can? Because, like, the bottom is starting to, like, fall out of it. Like, we inherited this trash can. We moved in. The trash can was already here. The city uses a special trash can. You can't just use whatever trash cans you have. So they all have to be uniform. And so we just kept the trash can. So now Joe's got himself a new trash can. I'm thinking all is right in the world. Well, here's the thing. We get to the next trash day. I go to take my new shiny trash can out to the curb. And, you know, I'm kind of like got a little swagger in my walk with my new trash can. The wheels work a little bit better. It's not squeaking. And I go to set it on the curb and I notice the curb is full. We put all of our trash cans in the same little section of curb, me and my neighbors. And the curb is full because Joe's old trash can has been pushed out to the curb. I look in it, it's empty. So my thought is that like some nosy neighbor, so either the neighbors I talked to are lying to me, but they're nice people. I'd like to believe they're not lying to me. Or some other nosy neighbor was like, oh, we're not supposed to leave our trash cans out this long. I'm just going to take his trash can in and put it back out there on trash day. And, you know, maybe he'll learn his lesson. So, you know, while that was kind of annoying that I had to deal with that, now Joe has two trash cans, including a brand new one. So now I have a trash can I can push out there if I ever have like overrun trash, you know, if I have more bags than I normally have. So I feel like everything's coming up Joe on this story, as frustrating as it was to return home and have no trash can. Now I've got two, and the brand new shiny one is, you know, kind of the belle of the ball right now.
So for everyone that speculated the HOA had abducted Joe's trash can, it looks like that might not have been the case.
Yeah, I just think it's, you know, and look, I'm, you know, I think sometimes HOAs can be kind of obnoxious and they kind of create these, some would say arbitrary rules to just as a way to try to control the neighborhood, if you will. That's a kind way of putting it. But that being said, like, I understand wanting to keep your neighborhood up. Like, I enjoy that. We live in a neighborhood I'm proud to live in. So I get that on some base level, but it just kind of felt like maybe a neighbor overstepped a little bit and was like, what is this trash can doing? It's been out here for, you know, X number of days. Like, I'm going to take matters into my own hands. Like, that's my working theory here. I'll probably never be able to prove that, but that's kind of what I'm going with here. So it just feels like somebody who felt like they were doing the right thing, but ultimately, you know, in my mind, maybe overstepped a little bit.
All right. So for everyone wondering about the results of Trash Can Gate, as we're going to call it, I think hopefully that's the last update we have. You know, I would hope that there's no more chapters to this story, but we thank you for listening and supporting Joe in this difficult time. Today on the podcast, we want to hit on a couple news items before we get to our interview with Mark Kingston, which we're going to have coming up here right in a minute. And I guess, Joe, the biggest piece of news from the last week around college baseball is that the ACC has settled on a scheduling model. And so they are going to play 12 weekends of three games apiece, 12 conference weekends of three games apiece, allow for two non-conference weekends and, you know, other non-conference games. Still starting on opening day, they're only going to play 50, down from 56 games is the plan. The extra weekends gives them a little more flexibility and a little more certainty about testing regimens, that everyone's up to speed on all of that. It's a solid model, it seems like. When we talked about how the SEC has been kicking around their ideas, it's one of the ideas that the SEC has kicked around. Other conferences have talked about similar things, but especially in a conference like the ACC that has 14 conference teams, very easy to just kind of expand the number of conference weekends you're playing. And I think a lot of those coaches are happy that they're sticking at three games a weekend as opposed to four.
Yeah, four games is just going to be tough. I mean, it is a solution. I'm glad that it was discussed, because it, in a world where it looked like we were going to have to play maybe a 10 weekends period, perhaps that was a more of a viable solution. So I appreciate that it was discussed, because it was a little bit outside the box and then they're trying everything. And I think one of the things you and I have talked about a lot throughout this offseason, we just really kind of wanted there to be some imagination about scheduling. So that was good. But ultimately, ACC settles on a pretty normal layout. And I don't think, given that it's 50 games, given that it's the ACC, which, by the way, you know, starts its conference play a week earlier than, say, the SEC, because it usually built in for most teams was building in a week of non-conference play during the middle of the season. Now that will not be the case.
Well, it was it's an idle weekend because some teams in the ACC, some schools need a finals break.
There
North
is,
Carolina,
yeah.
Duke, Georgia Tech, for instance. I'm forgetting somebody. I think that all take a committed weekend off during the regular season because of finals.
Yeah, there it is. So yeah, thank you for that context there. So yes, they start a little bit earlier. So now we're only talking like 1 week earlier than that. So not only does that feel pretty familiar, but also 50 games. Look, I'm a guy who, you know, to use a phrase, when it comes to the college baseball season, I like to eat the whole animal. Like, I'm not only watching the big ACC and SEC series, but I'm doing some of the random 2 p.m. on a Tuesday midweek games. Like, I really do enjoy that aspect. But even for me, I just don't know that I'm going to miss those six games. I mean, I want to have them in 2022. Don't get me wrong. Like, I don't want us to for 50 games to be a starting point moving forward. But for a one-year deal, when you consider some of the more dire alternatives that were maybe in play or were thought to be in play at other points, like, I'll take 50 games. When you consider that those six games, what's going to be sacrificed probably, and, you know, we talk about this a little bit with Coach Kingston, you know, I'll let you listen to what he says about the Clemson series, for example, but we're probably not losing those types of games. What we're probably losing are the midweek games against the mid or low major school a couple hours down the road, because those schools aren't maybe going to have the same level of rigorous testing. They're just not going to be, you know, it's an easy game to cut. We'll put it that way. And so those are more of the types of games that are kind of missing. And as much as I want those games to continue into the future, because those are good opportunities for those mid and low major schools for sure, given what we were dealing with here in 2020, I don't think those games are necessarily going to be missed in the grand scheme of things. So I think it's what they've landed on, I think, is for the college baseball fan, I think this is good news about the proposal they've landed on. And now, obviously, we have to execute it. That's a whole different deal. We've seen some of the fits and starts that basketball has had. We've talked a little bit about the differences in basketball and baseball and how there are some advantages for baseball. So now they have to execute that schedule. But as a starting point, I like where we've landed.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that it's a pretty solid plan. Yeah, the devil's in the details and in the execution. Each of these ACC teams is going to have to cut at least one non-conference weekend. Like I said, so many of them take a weekend off anyway because of finals, that there a lot of them are only playing three non-conference weekends. Those schools would only have to cut one, and frankly, they're for the most part going to be losing a low major weekend. Virginia last year, I just have their schedule up. Oklahoma, Bucknell, Dartmouth. In this case, Dartmouth would probably go because of the uncertainties of the Ivy League. But you know, a series like that is what we're eliminating, or two series like that. Obviously not something we want to repeat, but in this particular year, totally understandable. I think the ACC coaches, athletic departments, presidents, everyone that had to sign off on that should be applauded for what they've come up with. I think it's a workable plan, to the extent that any of these plans are workable. Obviously, we've seen games canceled in just about every sport to this point. So reasonable to assume that not every team is going to play every game in college baseball as well, but it seems like a totally reasonable approach. We'll see where that all goes. We'll see what the SEC does with it. But hopefully we are able to see some of those great SEC-ACC matchups on the diamond that we weren't able to see on the football field this year. Miami and Florida, hopefully we get that. Hopefully we get Clemson and South Carolina and Georgia Tech and Kentucky and Louisville. And there's so many of these crossovers that are huge series in baseball, whether it's a midweek or a weekend. I just want to see them. And unfortunately, in football, we weren't able to see them this year. So hopefully we can get them in baseball. And we'll talk about that a little bit with Mark Kingston here, as well as the Gamecocks overall, which are just a very interesting team here as we look to 2021 and you know, the for a variety of reasons, they've got a lot coming back. They've got a lot of depth. Those are not unique situations, but I do think they're, you know, not uniquely positioned. There are other teams like this, but if we're going to talk about a breakout team potential, I think South Carolina could be that, because they were so far down from what their, you know, typical season is in 2019 when they missed the NCAA tournament. And then in 2020, they went 12-4, which sounds fine, and was, but they hadn't really done anything to break through on a national level yet. They lost their series to Clemson. They just hadn't had that big moment yet. So even if they were going to be much improved this spring, as many around the program and thought they were going to be, you know, this is, it's been a while since the larger college baseball, you know, nation, fan base, whatever, has seen South Carolina and has really been focused on them. So I think that that makes them very interesting to watch as we go into the 2021 season. So excited to hear from Mark Kingston about his team, and we'll get into that in a second. But first, check this out. Today on the Baseball America College podcast, we're excited to be joined by South Carolina coach Mark Kingston. The Gamecocks are a very intriguing team as we start looking ahead to the 2021 season. And coach, we're excited to be talking some baseball. It's close to the holidays, so happy holidays. And you know, the start of the season, not too far away now.
Yeah, same to you and everybody out there listening. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas. It's a great time of the year where we're all kind of enjoying being with our families and a little bit of downtime, but also we're all starting to really look forward to the baseball season starting and it being right around the corner. So this is a great time of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're talking about how we're talking here at the end of December, but let's rewind a couple months here and go back to the start of the fall. Just, it had been a long time since everyone had been able to get back out on the field, you know, see each other as a team. What was that like, just for everyone to be back together as a team after such a unusual spring, summer, such a trying time?
It was a breath of fresh air. I think we go back to March 11th, I think, when everything started to really start getting shut down. And so it had been a long time before we as coaches could interact and be with our players outside of Zoom meetings and FaceTimes and phone calls and texts and emails. It had been a really long time before we could, since we could really be on the field with our guys. And just, we all as coaches and players, we love that camaraderie of being on the field and being together and having meetings and helping guys improve and making adjustments. So you kind of go through a withdrawal for so long because it had been from March until late August and early September. So I think it was great for everybody to get back together, start to get that camaraderie again and move into the fall. So it had been a long time coming. Some guys had been able to go play summer ball and that was good for them. But in terms of us and our staff and our players all being together, it was great to finally reunite.
One of the other big things that happened between the time last season got cut off prematurely and coming back together in the fall is Carmen Majewski gets drafted by the Pirates. What was it like, even though it did get kind of cut off, what was it like to see him be able to put it all together, finally healthy, throwing the ball well, to put him in position to get drafted where he did? How rewarding was it to see him finally be able to do that and take those strides?
Yeah, we were really happy for him and his family. Had the opportunity to go down to Hilton Head this summer and saw him and spent some time with him along with Skylar Mead this summer when we all had some downtime and there wasn't a whole lot going on. And to watch him on TV, you know, during the draft, everybody was watching all the different broadcasts, and to see him with his family in their family room, get that call and have that all that hard work pay off for him. It's very rewarding. As a coach, that's one of the things you love about your job, is that you get to remember kids when they were in high school and then when they committed and then the process of going through freshman years and the ups and downs of that. And then you see them start to grow up and evolve, and you see the improvements they made, and you made a lot of great improvements with Skylar here over the course of the years. And then to finally see that all come to fruition with being a first round draft pick and and see him celebrate that with his family and talk to him afterwards. It's just, it's a really great part of our process here as college coaches and what we're allowed to do and be a part of.
Now with Carmen gone, that of course leaves, you know, a hole at the front of the rotation. You've got really no shortage of guys who can step up. Thomas Farr, Brandon Jordan, two of the more experienced guys on the staff. Who do you see kind of moving to the front of the rotation, and what's the next step for Thomas and for Brandon?
Well, I would say that's where you start with our pitching staff. That's where you start. You start with Farr and Jordan, and you're talking about two guys that are mid to upper 90s guys that have really good off-speed pitches. They have a little bit of a track record, not quite the track record of some guys because of 2020 being cut short. But in a short look, they both last year were very, very good. Looking at the stats, you know, Jordan had a 1.70 ERA, 32-9 strikeout to walk ratio, and opponents hit 104 against him. And with Farr, opponents hit 113 against him, and he gave up 6 hits in 15 innings with another 1.70 ERA, and he was 3-0 in the shortened season. So feel really good that those two guys can match up with just about anybody we'll face. And in the SEC, we know Fridays and Saturday nights and really the entire weekend, but it starts on Fridays. You're going to have to really have some big-time aces to match up in our league, and I feel like we'll be able to match up and go toe-to-toe with just about anybody in our league. And then on that given night, it's who pitches better, who plays better, et cetera. But I feel like we can match up with most teams now having Farr and Jordan there. And then, you know, past that, I think we have a lot of guys that have the potential to fill out that Sunday spot. If we had a game this weekend, Julian Bosnick would be that guy. He's a guy that has really come on. He's a left-handed pitcher out of Tampa, Florida, had Tommy John his first year, and now is coming into his second year off of surgery, and he is really blossoming. He's a lefty with really good command. Fastball was up to 96 this fall and has a really good breaking ball and change up. And he's a competitor, and he's a guy that has really exploded onto the scene with scouts as of late. And I think if we had a series this weekend, that's the three guys you would look at getting on the mound for us. And that's, to me, that matches up, and that's what we're asking for at this point in our process of building this program back up to where everybody wants it to be. It has to start on the mound. And I feel like with those three guys, we feel like we can go toe-to-toe with people. So past that, there's a lot of guys, you know, you look at the Tuesday spot. If we have a traditional model for our schedule where we get to play midweek games, then you're looking at, you know, a bunch of young, very talented guys fighting for that fourth starter spot right now. And feel very excited about the guys that we'll have to pick from for that spot as well.
One of the guys last year, for a couple of different reasons, that just didn't have the freshman season he was probably hoping for was Brennan Malone. And I had to imagine that's pretty new for him, a guy that maybe hasn't dealt with a ton of adversity like that. So, you know, how did you see that he dealt with that at the time? And then what have you seen from him since then, you know, to give you confidence that he could be the type of player that you guys are looking for him to be ultimately?
Yeah, what I think is lost on a lot of people, and because, again, you have hundreds and hundreds of baseball teams, and it's hard to keep track of the minutia and the details of every single team and their personnel. Brennan only played 5 games for us last year out of the 16. He was dealing with a hip injury, and he really, even in the games he played, he was not at 100%. He was just starting to come into his own as the season was canceled. His last game, he hit a home run to straightaway center field, and he was starting to get his legs underneath him. But we basically played most of last season without him. He's as talented a hitter as they come. Turned down 7 figures in the draft coming out of high school. Hit in the 3-hole for us when he was healthy. The last game, we hit him in the 3-hole. He's that talented of a hitter. And if he was healthy for us last year, I think you're looking at two or three more wins, and you turn a team that was 12-4 into a team that was probably 14-2. At minimum. So he's a guy that we're very excited about. He's come through that hip injury, and he is now 100% healthy, knock on wood. Had a really good fall for us, had a great summer playing here locally in the Coastal Plain League. So he's a guy that just the sky's the limit, and he's a very hard worker, and he's going to be right there in the middle of our lineup, helping us win a lot of baseball games, I think.
The nature of the 2021 college baseball season is such that teams are just deep. But when I look at your lineup, I see a lot of depth. I maybe don't see a ton of like traditional, like right now, surefire preseason All-Americans, but I see a lot of depth. Who do you think has the chance to maybe take that step forward and become an All-American at the end of the year? And, you know, how do you go about managing the depth that you and other teams do have this season?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say the first few guys you're looking at in terms of who are our, you know, our name guys, I think Eister and Allen out in the outfield are the first two guys you're going to look at. You know, both proven 300 hitters at this level. Both have very high on base percentages. Both have probably 55 to 60 power on the pro scouts grading scale. And they've really come along in the outfield defensively as well. So those are two guys that you're going to talk about as having, you know, the star type power. I think they'll really come into their own this year. Wes Clark is a guy that led the SEC in homers last year. He had 8 homers in 16 games for us last year in the 2020 season. And I think that's a guy that will have as much power production as just about anybody in the country. So I think starting with those three guys, you know, as three name hitters, and then you add Brennan Malone to that mix, I think you're looking at four guys that can really, again, match up with just about anybody we'll play. Whether they're named All-Americans yet or preseason All-Americans, that's to be determined. But I feel really good that those four guys right there give us a great starting spot. And then the guys past them, I think you're looking at some talented young guys and potentially a couple of transfers. You have Satterfield and Mendham, two left-handed hitters that one's a JUCO transfer, one's a transfer from Elon, who is about a 330 lifetime hitter. So I think that's where offensively you're looking at. And then Jeff Heinrich is a guy that we think can be a top 10 round draft pick at second base. And then you go into the outfield. Brandon Fields is a very exciting young freshman center fielder for us. And he's battling with Noah Myers, who hit 324 for us last year out in center field. So, you know, I think around the infield, you just feel really good. In the outfield, you feel good. Colin Burgess, I think, is a very underrated catcher, both offensively and defensively. And then at shortstop, we've got some really good options in Khalil Robinson and the young Jalen Vasquez. So I feel really good that we have, like you said, you know, maybe they're not star names yet, but I think some of them will develop into that. And then depth, even names I haven't mentioned yet, we feel really good about the depth as well. So it's a roster that I think we can really work with.
One of the reasons why college baseball has the depth that it does, obviously, is, you know, a lot of teams bringing back a lot of players that might have otherwise moved on to pro baseball or whatever is next in their lives. And on top of that, you add a recruiting class, and you guys are in that position as well, bringing in another outstanding recruiting class on top of everything you have coming back. And I imagine that creates a little bit of a unique coaching challenge. And so I'm a little bit curious as to A, how you approach the fall and evaluation with, you know, having to bring in a class like that, a bunch of guys who probably expected to play right away, or at least challenge for that, with a bunch of guys who are a little more proven. And then, you know, what kind of conversations maybe that led with some of those players. And I imagine it led to some frank conversations just about expectations coming in that might've been a little bit different than what you had expected when you began recruiting them a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Again, another great question. I think you've got to be honest with them. Number one, you've got to be honest and you've got to let them know the situation. And this is a very, very talented freshman / transfer class we brought in this year. And they all want to play right away. Of course they do. Everybody on our team wants to play. Everybody on our team wants to be a starter. So what we did this fall is we played probably more games and had more innings pitched and had more at-bats than we've ever had. And so what I found from that is guys really had an opportunity, one, to get better because they're playing great competition in practice every day. But it also gave them probably as good a look at how they rate compared to the competition as any fall I've ever been a part of. And been doing this a long time, been very fortunate to be a part of some great programs. And the guys in our post-fall meetings were much more realistic than I've ever heard, because they saw, okay, that's what an SEC Friday night guy looks like. So if you're a pitcher, you know, okay, I'm not to that point yet. I think I can get there, but I'm not there yet, because they were exposed so much to it this fall. Same way with the hitters. The hitters didn't have a chance to, you know, maybe take 25 at bats in a fall and kind of not get overexposed or not fool you or themselves. I thought our guys got a really good look at what the competition is, what it takes at this level. And so when I met with our freshmen this fall, I sensed a much more realistic approach to where they think they are in our program, what they think their role and their playing time should be. And so I think that's a very positive thing. Now, when push comes to shove and a guy's not in the lineup that thought he would be or hoped he would be, you know, how is that going to be handled? You know, that's going to be, for all coaches around the country, that's going to be a challenge. And so our approach is just going to continue to be communication, honesty, and let them know that, you know, Dan McDonald, who I was on the USA team a couple of years ago with, I thought had a great quote during the draft, because they asked him a very similar question. And his answer was, if you think your freshman year is going to be the highlight of your career, then you're not going to have a very good career. So what we're trying to stress with our guys is this is one chapter in a very long book of your career. And so whether you're in the lineup that day or not, you're going to have to continue to treat it as another day of development. And when everything comes out in the wash, your career will work out the way it's supposed to work out. So along the way, just be a great teammate, keep working to get better. And if you're the best guy on that day to help us win, you'll be in the lineup. So I think the challenge is going to be there for everybody. Everybody has more players than they're used to having. Everybody has more depth and older players back than they're used to having. So that communication, that honesty, that big picture, I think is going to be important for a lot of different people.
The South Carolina Clemson rivalry is one that a lot of people look forward to every year. Uncertain times, of course. I know the SEC is still working on figuring out what the best model for its schedule will be for the spring. But what's your best guess or hope about what can happen for that series this year?
I think we'll find a way to play one way or another. I think the challenge will be, how does the SEC schedule match up compared to the ACC schedule? The ACC is playing a couple more weekends of baseball within conference right now. And my guess is at the time of this being recorded, that we may do the same thing. So if we only have two weekends of non-conference action, it'll just be a matter of hoping that the two non-conference weekends for us match up. If they do, then I think we'll be able to try to find a way to play a weekend. If they don't, we can't make the weekends work, then I think we probably would try to be creative with Tuesday or Wednesday night games. I just think the series is too important to too many people within our state, nationally, players, coaches, fans. There's just too many people that are in love with this series to not try to play it and exhaust every opportunity we may have. And I've talked to Monty Lee about the series, and we're on the same page. We both really want to play it. It's just so good for our sport. And so we'll do everything we can to try to make sure that these two teams get to play.
One of the things that happens as you and as someone like yourself who has been a head coach in a few different places, has had success in a few different places, is you start to kind of develop a coaching tree. Guys who have coached for you start to break off and get opportunities themselves. And one of them, of course, most notably is Billy Mole, who took over at South Florida once you moved to South Carolina. And I'm curious about, you know, what you saw in Billy specifically and knew that he could become a head coach, but also more generally about the work as a head coach of developing your assistant coaches right alongside developing your players.
Yeah, that's something I think all coaches take a lot of pride in. I take a lot of pride in being a part of the Jim Morris coaching tree and, you know, having grown up in that included Rick Jones and, you know, Rob Cooper and Gino DeMari and myself and Greg Lovelady. So I take great pride in having grown up on that coaching tree. And now I also take great pride in players that I have coached or coaches that have been assistants with me getting their opportunities. And I look at Matt Reiser at Southeastern, Ryan Copeland at Illinois Springfield, and Billy Mole at South Florida. Bo Durkheck was the head coach at Illinois State when I went to South Florida. Take a lot of pride in guys like that. And Greg Lovelady was a player at Miami when I was an assistant. He's a head coach at UCF. So I take a lot of great pride in you know, helping guys. That's what this business is all about. We all love baseball, but a thing we all really love about it is the relationships and the impact you can have on people. And so I'd like to think that in some small way, I've helped those guys the same way Jim Morris helped me and Rick Jones helped me. So that's something we take a lot of great pride in, stay in close touch. You know, I talk to Billy quite often and Bo quite often, and Reiser and Copeland are guys that, you know, I don't talk to quite as much, but I know they're having great success. So it's something you, as a coach, you take a lot of pride in, because you want to see your players really move on and maximize their abilities as players and what they can do in the game. But you feel the same way about your coaches as well.
From the outside, looking at South Carolina, some of the things, you know, you see about the program or just how invested the fans are in the history, of course, the tradition that Ray Tanner was able to build and, you know, take to the College World Series success that he did, and, you know, a great stadium. You know, so those are just kind of things you can see from the outside. I'm sure you saw them when you were, you know, elsewhere in the country. But now that you're inside the program there, what have you learned about the program, about the job, since you arrived in Columbia a few years ago?
What I've learned is just they share the same passion for the sport here that I've always had, whether I was playing or coaching. And that's something you want to be a part of. And I don't know that was new. I kind of assumed that from the outside, but just getting to see it and feel it from the inside out. This state takes a lot of pride in South Carolina baseball. And you just, when you come to work every day, you feel it, and you want to work hard to make those people proud. Look, this program has two national championships. And so that's what they want the standard to be. And that's when we recruit or we run a practice, that's what we expect the standard to be. Is this getting us closer to that goal? So having Ray Tanner as the AD, obviously it's great to have that voice there, that sounding board. If you have a question about something, you know, how the program is being run, you can easily get him on the phone and say, hey, tell me when you had it rocking and rolling in 2010, 11, et cetera. You know, how did you handle a situation like this? Or what part of the state or country did you really seem to find great players from, or diamonds in the rough? To me, it's a program that has everything that's necessary. It has the stadium, it has the fan base, it has the support, and they provide for us what we need to be competitive at the highest level. So I wouldn't say that I've learned anything new about the program, because I assumed everything was at the absolute highest level from inside and out. And what I found is that is very much true.
So one of the things that has come up over the last, you know, extended off season that we've been in, I can't even remember how many months ago it was, but, you know, the idea of a new model in college baseball. And, you know, since the fall started, we haven't heard as much about it for a variety of reasons, but you've now had a lot of time to look at that, think of it over, and you've coached at so many different places. I'm interested in what you think of the idea of pushing the season back, pushing everything back about a month that was being discussed in that proposal.
I would generally be for it. I think this is a sport that's best played in warm weather. The problem is that everybody has a different reason why they can and can't do, you know, a backed up schedule. You look at the teams in the North, and I coached at Illinois State as the head coach there. And yeah, you would love to push the season back a month so that you get to play more warm weather games and you don't always have to travel for the first 3 or 4 weeks of the season. But then most Northern schools are not interested in housing players in dorms over the summer. That's just the fact of life right now. And especially with the pandemic and everything we've gone through, schools are not looking to add costs. They're looking to decrease costs. And so I think everybody in the country generally understands and thinks that if we could move the season back, that would be ideal. More games and more warm weather, push it into the summer, where, you know, there's been arguments made that a lot of great rivalries could have tremendous fan support, whether it's a Michigan, Ohio State, or, maybe those rivalries will start to get the kind of fan support that a Clemson, South Carolina get, or a Miami, Florida. I think that's the goal, and that would be what people are shooting for. Whether it's realistic, I just don't know. But I think generally people would love to push the season back, but there's just so many logistical reasons why the support of administrations and the NCAA may or may not be behind it. And I know ESPN feels pretty good about where the College World Series falls right now, and there may be some trepidation in them moving it back. So I just think there's so many moving pieces here that we all know what we'd love it to be. Whether we could actually get there or not, you know, that's the million-dollar question.
So we'll wrap here with the same question we end each podcast with each of our guests. I will ask the question, then I will filibuster for a second to give you a little bit of time to brainstorm. But we ask all of our guests to describe their favorite sandwich. And so some people take it in the direction of they just describe how they would make their favorite sandwich. They tell us the bread and then the condiments, the meat, the vegetables, whatever it is they put on their sandwich. Other people go in a different direction. And they tell us about a specific sandwich at a local place that they really, really like. So we're not picky. You can go in any of those directions. Feel free to take it however you like. But Mark Kingston, please describe to us your favorite sandwich.
Okay. Well, I'll give you two if I'm allowed.
Absolutely.
The first one I'll give you is, and the Florida people will appreciate this, a buffalo chicken tender sandwich from Publix. That's always high on the list. And then the second one I'll give you is a local here in Columbia at a deli called Groucho's. It's called the STP, and it has roast beef, turkey, and ham. It has a special sauce, much like a Cane's sauce or a Zaxby's sauce. It's a special sauce, and it has bacon bits on it, and it's served warm. And so I would say for me, those would be my top two choices. So Publix or Groucho's, if I'm looking to get a sandwich, that's where I'm heading.
You know, I've heard so much about these Publix subs and the chicken tender subs specifically. I've never lived somewhere that had a Publix, but it really feels like I'm missing out.
Well, the next time you're covering an SEC or an ACC game in Florida, there's a Publix on every corner. So make sure you hit them up.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt about that.
It is. It's a good grocery store, you know, beyond just the sandwich situation.
For sure.
So we, you know, we're very excited to hear about the Gamecocks today, and we're even more excited to see you guys out on the field this spring. It's been a long time, so you know, we're looking forward to that, and we appreciate you taking the time, to run through everything about the Gamecocks with us ahead of that 2021 season.
No, I appreciate you guys having me on. I appreciate the promotion you guys do for our sport. It's much appreciated by a lot of people, fans, coaches, players, etc. So really appreciate you having me on, and can't wait for a great NCAA 2021 college baseball season.
Thank you again to South Carolina coach Mark Kingston for joining us today on the Baseball America College Podcast. Joe, it's like I said when I was, we were running into that interview, interesting team overall. Kind of confusing when you look at some various things about them. Just when I was looking at the reminding myself of how the spring went for them, they lost a series to Northwestern at home. They lost to the series against Clemson, but they finished 12-4, which is a very solid start to the season overall. And you look at what they have returning. You look at the talent level. You look at the the newcomers, another top 15 recruiting class on the way in. And, it shapes up to be a team that I think can compete in the SEC East at a pretty high level. You know, we're not sure what Georgia is going to look like this year. We're kind of expecting them to take a bit of a step back after all that they've lost. Tennessee is in, an interesting spot as well. Behind Florida and Vanderbilt, the SEC East looks to be a little more open. And I think that plays to South Carolina's advantage this year.
Oh, it totally does. Yeah. It's a really interesting team. And one of the just general subplots about this college baseball season that I think we'll end up writing about a little bit. And you and I have had conversations about how we write about this and what it all encompasses. But one of the big subplots here is, okay, yes, just about every team in college baseball is deeper this year, is more talented this year than they've ever been. But how does that get expressed? What does that mean? Because you've got teams that are really, really experienced. You know, I think of a team like TCU. We had Jim Schlossnagel on the show several weeks ago. Really, really experienced team. But the question is, well, how much high-end talent is there? And a lot of it is on the pitching staff and is just kind of unproven. Maybe that proves itself. But that's a team where I think the sum is going to be greater than the parts. South Carolina is in a place where you really like the individual parts, and we're still kind of waiting on the sum. And you talked about those series losses last year that were a little bit confounding. And then you look at the individual stats and the individual talents, and you're like, well, you know, wow, this is a really talented group. I really like this group individually. And we're still just kind of waiting for that last hump to be jumped over, if you will, with this particular group. And maybe that would have come in 2020. Now, of course, we delay to 2021, but I think that's what gives me a little bit of pause and what might be reflected. We have not had the full top 25 discussion between the two of us to put the preseason 25 together, but they're going to be in the mix. But how high they end up in the mix really just has a lot to do with how confident are we that, you know, that this is all going to click together, because we believe in the talent. The results on an individual level were great in 2020, so we like what we see there. But, you know, is that enough to put them over some of these teams that just year after year after year they're in the mix? You know, teams like, you know, a team that we talked about maybe them being in the mix with in terms of pecking orders, a team like NC State, where that's an interesting dichotomy because you might like the individual talents in South Carolina more, but, you know, NC State's going to win 36, 37, 38, maybe 40 games and, you know, challenge to maybe host a regional, and they're going to be in the postseason, and you just know what you're going to get there. With South Carolina, we're not really exactly sure yet. So we can say that we really like the individual pieces, and I do, and you do, but we're still just kind of waiting a little bit to see what it amounts to in 2021. And that's part of what makes me really excited to see it on the field.
Yeah, absolutely. They've been on this every other year roller coaster where they go to super regionals or they miss the NCAA tournament. And now that was either paused or broken last year because the season got canceled too early for us to find out. But last year was supposed to be a super regional year, if you look at it. You know, it's been going on for like 5 years that, you know, they miss the NCAA tournament, then they go to super regionals, and they miss it again, and then they go to super regionals, and then they miss it again. And you know, then 2020 happened. It's a little confounding. I know it's frustrating for South Carolina fans, but if that's the cycle that Mark Hinston has to break here, that, you know, as his tenure continues, that he inherited that, you know, that was he inherited a team that had missed the NCAA tournament in 2 out of 3 years and had had that super regional in the middle. And then he goes to super regionals in his first year, and then in 19 takes a step back. So he now has to, you know, his mission is to get them, first of all, just to stabilize it, get them to be the consistent regional team that, you know, South Carolina should be, and then, or the consistent super regional team, even if you want that, you know, and then try and get back to where they were at the start of the decade when they were in 3 straight finals and won back-to-back titles. That's where they're eventually trying to build to, but before that, they just need to get a bit more of that consistency. And there's every reason to believe that they can do that. But to do that, they really need in 2021 to take that step forward that, you know, we're expecting, that we're now looking for. You know, it's too much to say at this point that they're going to be there with Florida and Vanderbilt at the end of the season, though I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility, but that's too much to put on them now. But if they can just be in the mix to not only make the tournament, but in the mix to host, I think that would be a very solid 2021 season for a team that is simultaneously old but inexperienced, because they're older because there's a lot of JUCO talent on this team. You know, we mentioned guys like Thomas Farr and Brandon Jordan. You know, so they're older, but they don't have that much more experience, just because, at least in SEC play, in college baseball overall, yes. But we don't know necessarily yet how they're going to hold up against the rigors of SEC play.
That is interesting. The roster construction really is kind of fascinating, because, you know, the level of JUCO talent, or let's just say draft eligible talent, to put a broader brush there, makes it to where there is a little bit of urgency here. And they've continued to recruit well. So I'm not suggesting that, you know, if in 21 they're good but not great, you know, they get to a regional and that's kind of it. They lose a bunch of talent draft. Like, that's, I'm not saying that's ball game for the program. Clearly that's not the case with the way they've been recruiting. But if they want to win with this group, there is a little bit of urgency there, because they do have a lot of guys who are going to be of interest to talent evaluators. And in a world where, you know, we're not going back to a, and I will let the guys who cover the pro side at Baseball America really say definitively, but, you know, it's not likely we're going back to a 40-round draft. We're probably looking at something like 20, but even in a 20-round draft, there's a lot of players in South Carolina that are going to be of interest. And let's be honest, a lot of guys drafted later in the 20th round probably come back to school anyway. So those are the players we're really talking about. The pitching side draws attention because there are guys like Farr and Brandon Jordan. And also there's a little bit of word association with South Carolina in pitching that is well-earned. I do have a sneaking suspicion this team might mash, though. One of the things that I could have gotten a little bit deeper in if we had more time with him was kind of what is the nature of this team on offense? Because, you know, they did lose a guy, Noah Campbell, a guy who'd been in the program for a long time, but, you know, he's got some athleticism, some base stealing ability. You know, maybe he's a guy that never really put all the tools together in a South Carolina uniform, but you can't really doubt the athleticism, the speed side of the game and what he brought to the table there. There are probably guys in the lineup who are going to bring that in 2021. I don't think that goes away, but I do think it is going to be a pretty power oriented team. You know, guys like Andrew Eister and Wes Clark. Wes Clark had 8 home runs last year. That's quite a bit for 16 games. But then you look at a guy we talked about, Brendan Malone, which, you know, he talks about him being the best bat they have. And with what we saw in 2020, if he's the best bat they have, and he was a guy who didn't really get much of a chance to play in 2020, that really bodes well for this team offensively in 2021. And that's kind of a piece that's been a little bit missing. There have been recent years where South Carolina's offense, you're kind of like, where are the dudes? They maybe have one guy at a time who has a big year, but there just isn't a lot of depth there. I think this is a year where they really are going to have some mashers throughout the order versus just having one guy that everything kind of revolves around.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the offense over the last, you know, I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush here, but at least at the, you know, in 15, 16, 17, maybe in 18 as well. Frankly, I don't remember the 2019 season, as it relates to South Carolina. I don't think I saw the Gamecocks that year, but, you know, nothing really big stands out. So I don't want to necessarily paint them with this brush, but a lot of it was, you know, just a lot more contact oriented than it was power oriented. And for a while there, you know, you think about some of the best hitters as college hitters, they were really, you know, kind of contact oriented guys. The power never really came. And, you know, at your best, especially in that ballpark, I feel like you're going to need to eventually, you know, hit some home runs. And, you know, so if they can do that, if Eister and Clark and, you know, Malone can become those kinds of players, you know, that bodes pretty well for them. I mean, they still have some athletic guys that can get on base and run around, which is obviously an important part of building your lineup as well. But I do think that would be big for them if they could get some more consistent power in there, because I think when it comes down to it, you need some power bats. And so if they've got that now, if they can mix this all together, they've got a lot to work with there. And, you know, I mean, Noah Campbell is a big name. He was a 2-time preseason All-American. He had a really nice summer on the Cape going into his draft year, but he also never did it in Columbia, really. So if that's the guy that you lost, unfortunate that he never was able to put it together for you wearing a South Carolina uniform. But at the same time, it was a little more promise than it was fulfilled potential in terms of what he was bringing. So, you know, I don't want to minimize the loss, but it's a little different losing that kind of player than losing, you know, a first round pick or a guy even like Mladjinski who went just outside of the first round. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the pitching staff comes together without Mladjinski. He's by far been their best pitcher over the last couple of years, even with his injury. You know, so it, I like what they have overall. I think the pitching staff can be really deep if they can get some of these hitters to take that step forward. I think this team ends up being pretty interesting, but you know, we'll just have to wait and see on them and debate them a little bit in terms of our top 25 discussions. I'm not quite sure where they're going to land, but I do think, you know, right now, if you go and look at our Never Too Early top 25 that we did coming out of the summer, we don't have South Carolina. I would expect that to change. I've been encouraged by what I've heard this fall and what I've, you know, looked into around the Gamecocks, but you know, where exactly that means they're going to end up in the rankings. I guess you'll just have to check back in a few weeks.
Yeah. It's just to give a little context on the offensive discussion, because you mentioned it, you know, the 2019 team, you look at it and there was some power there. They had four guys that had double digit home runs. The problem was they hit .236 as a team.
Yeah. So it's not going to get it done. You gotta do both.
Yeah. Right. You kind of have to have both pieces there. So that was, you know, but it's kind of been a mix of guys, so that they've had guys who have been really good for short periods of time. I think about a guy like Carlos Cortez that kind of came in and, mm-hmm. and provided some thunder, but it's a pretty narrow window there, or guys who maybe were inconsistent or took a while to get going. LT Tolbert and Jonah Bride, guys like that, who we kind of waited on and they had their moments in the sun. Alex Destino, I guess, you know, was a guy who kind of fits into that. So it was this kind of back and forth between guys who took a while to get there or were a little bit inconsistent, or guys who had good numbers but did it for a pretty short period of time. This offense has an opportunity, I think, to kind of put it all together at once and hit with the same kind of power that we saw in 2019, but hopefully hit a little bit better than .236.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll see where they go from there. You know, within the context of you know, breakouts and stuff, you know, let's talk a little bit more about Brendan Malone, Joe, who we had our top 25 last week was breakout candidates. Brendan Malone landed on that list. And you mentioned that we could have put more South Carolina players on that list, and we certainly could have. Thomas Farr could have gone on there. I know you mentioned a couple other guys that could have been on there. I mean, frankly, I think the team is a breakout team. So, you know, what about Brendan Malone? You know, we've talked about it a little bit, you know, or some of those other guys that, you know, within the Gamecocks program that you think could be the breakout potentials.
Yeah, Brendan Malone caught my eye because of a lot of what Coach Kingston said, where, you know, he was injured last year, played just five games, and I don't care who you are, if you've missed some time early in the season, then you get thrown back into it, it's going to be hard to get your swing going in five games. And he was showing signs there at the tail end of those five games. But you take that, and then, you know, we've started the process of doing team previews and stuff like that. So we've got a little bit of inside information, if you will. And that's a guy who they're penciling right back in as the three hitter in that lineup. And when you talk about the guys they bring back, we just got done talking to Coach Kingston about it. In a lineup full of guys that they're pretty confident in, the fact that they're going to say, Brendan Malone, you're going to hit right back in the middle of this order, and we think we're confident you're going to be our best guy. Well, I mean, now you're talking about a real dude. And that's kind of what we expected coming into last year. He was one of the more anticipated position players coming into college baseball last year, and the injuries and just the season being cut off when it didn't give him an opportunity to show what he could do. So if you take someone who dealt with the adversity he did, and now they pencil him in to be right in the middle of the order and be their best guy. Well, that's really enough for me. Now he still has to do it. That's the thing, but that's what really struck me about him. This list in general kind of fits into two buckets for me. There's bucket number one, which is hyper talented guys that are just unproven because they haven't had the time. Jack Leiter, I think Jaden Hill to some degree fits into this. He's kind of between the buckets, which I'll give you my other bucket here in a second. But Nate Savino, I think, fits into that bucket. Brooks Lee, certainly in that bucket. Then the other bucket is guys who have kind of bided their time. Maybe it's because they're on a really talented team and they just haven't had their opportunities. Maybe it's a guy who's taken a big jump. Richard Fitz at Auburn is a guy who's, you know, coming close to triple digits on his fastball now. He's been a nice piece for Auburn the last few years, but now he looks like he's a Friday dude for Auburn, and that could be a real game changer now that they're replacing Tanner Burns. One guy that I would call out is Glenn Albanese at Louisville, who fits into that second bucket. He's thrown 18 and a third innings over 2 years, and granted, one of those years was 2020, and maybe he's a guy who really becomes a, a bullpen stalwart in 2020, but he just never got that chance. But he's a guy that Louisville's looking at on Fridays now. He came back in the fall, was one of the stars of the fall for Louisville. He's another guy whose stuff has taken a jump, you know, with his fastball now sitting in the mid-90s, touching the high 90s. And he's important because Louisville needs it. You know, Luke Smith is back in the fold. So that's a guy you trust in the rotation. But, you know, they lost Reed Detmers and Bobby Miller as first-round picks. So they've got two spots at the front of the rotation. And ultimately, you'd like it if Luke Smith is your Sunday guy. Like, Luke Smith is a nice piece, but you want him to be the Sunday guy, and you want a couple guys with a little higher ceiling on those first 2 days on the weekend. And so if Albanese can step up and be that Friday guy, he's got the stuff to do it. Like, that sounds like a Louisville Friday guy. Guy firing high 90s fastball is going to try to blow it by you. The numbers have been good in his career. He just has never taken on this role. And that's one I'm going to be watching closely, because I think his success level doing that is going to have a lot to say about what Louisville ends up being. A team that's very, very good, love their position players, but do they have the type of Friday night guy they're used to having?
Yeah, that's, I mean, they got a lot of options. And, you know, Albanese is a good one, but you think about Prosecchi, you know, and they have, you know, who is so good for them already in a lesser role. Can he now step up? Can they get a guy like Michael Kurian to move from the bullpen and do it? They've got options. And, you know, so it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. But, you know, Albanese is, you know, it's an intriguing one. And, you know, I think when, you know, maybe when we set out, when I envisioned this list, I was hoping to uncover more guys like Glenn Albanese. And because that's important to be able to identify those players now, or at least like that's cool if we can identify them now. But it wound up being that we also had to include a guy like Jack Leiter, who is probably one of the most famous people in college baseball, but, you know, frankly, hasn't done what you would expect him to do to have that fame and to, you know, be considered a top, you know, five pick in the upcoming draft class. So if he's going to live up to that draft status, if he's going to have effectively a breakout season, or at least take a big step forward on the mound. And so that leads to him and Jaden Hill and Nate Savino, guys who we're not questioning in any way their upside or their talent. But, you know, that's why those guys are leading this list, because they still have another gear to get to really kind of live up to the hype that is currently surrounding them.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, I'm more interested in, not that I'm like, look, I'm looking forward to seeing Jack Leiter and Jaden Hill pitch, Nate Savino. Like, I really am looking forward to that, especially given the way last season ended. But I like you, I'm kind of more interested in the guys who we've kind of had to dig a little bit, or guys that have been around and maybe just made a big jump in their development. So and that's why this list was kind of fun. It's a little bit of a mix of those type of guys. A couple others that I thought of or that I made particular note of, or one is Jonathan Cannon, which if you substitute Georgia and Jonathan Cannon into the discussion we just had about Louisville and Glenn Albanese, you've kind of got the same thing where Hancock and Wilcox get drafted, and Jonathan Cannon's kind of the guy we're looking at as, okay, is he ready to be the Friday guy? The other is Brock Jones at Stanford, super good athlete, played football, played defensive back at Stanford, gave up football, focusing on baseball. And look, the Stanford offense just needs somebody to be a difference maker in the lineup. I like some of what they have on the mound. I think they're going to pitch okay. But last year, in a small sample, granted, the offense was just not good. So I'm not saying it has to all be Brock Jones, but he looks like a guy that could be a difference maker there for a team that really, really needs it.
Yeah, I'm interested in that for sure. I also would want to throw out Parker Messick at Florida State, who was really good out of the bullpen in a multi-inning role as a freshman last year. And now Florida State has two open spots like Louisville in their rotation after CJ Van Eyck and Shane Drohan move on to pro ball. And Messick has put himself in a position this fall where he's probably going to start the season in Florida State's rotation, potentially could be their opening day starter. They, like Louisville, have, you know, an experienced guy in Connor Grady still in the rotation, but Grady's not a typical Friday starter. So if Messick can come in and provide that, that would be that'd be big for the Noles. And he shut down Florida in what wound up being the Gators' last game of the season. I guess the Noles played again the next night, but you know, out of the bullpen that night in Gainesville, Parker Messick looked outstanding. So if he can do that over an extended outing, he would be excellent for Florida State at the front of the rotation, and would really, really be a nice, you know, having lost what they lost, that would be a great thing for them to be able to plug in a guy like that into their rotation. I'm also interested in JP Massey at Minnesota. He's a guy that has a lot of potential, has pitched a decent amount for the Gophers, 44 innings so far, hasn't really put it together yet, but Max Meyer is gone. And so they've got a hole as well at the front of the rotation. Massey has the kind of arm to fill that and to fill it really well. The question now is just going to be, can he do it consistently enough to lead the Gophers rotation this year?
Yeah, the Minnesota team is interesting. Not to do a deep dive here, but I think it's an interesting position player group they have, and I'm really interested to see Massey as well. And you know, you would have liked to have seen a little earlier. You know, not players develop on their own timelines. This is not me being hard on JP Massey, but I'm just saying that, you know, one of the things that Minnesota has kind of struggled with the last couple of years, especially with the drop-off that Patrick Fredrickson has struggled with after his outstanding freshman year, is finding a complementary piece in the rotation consistently for Max Meyer. They've had years where I think the team was good enough in a lot of different spots, but it was just Max Meyer and then being really unsure what they were going to get the rest of the week. And now, of course, Meyer is gone, so there's a little bit more pressure on just finding anybody to really be super consistent on the weekends. And I'll be fascinated to see if Massey is indeed that guy.
Absolutely. And the Gophers could use it. And McCade Brown at Indiana in a similar spot. Heard a lot about what he did this summer. Now he's going to have to do it for the Hoosiers. So a couple of Big Ten arms that are interesting. And, you know, we could have put maybe a Sean Burke on here at Maryland to stay on the Big Ten theme. But it was also, frankly, kind of hard to figure out who has broken out already in a short season. And ultimately, we decided Sean Burke was too good. He'd already broken out, even if that's a name that, you know, college baseball fans are maybe a little unfamiliar about, because it was happening at Maryland. And, you know, he was doing it as a redshirt freshman after being injured in 2019. So, you know, some names might be missing from this list. Joe, who else, you know, kind of fit that Sean Burke mold?
Yeah, that was the tough thing where I, you know, somebody tweeted, I happened to just kind of catch it, but somebody tweeted the Baseball America account when this top 25 went live and asked, well, hasn't Jack Leiter kind of already broken out? He was awesome in 2020. And that's true. But you know,
I mean, he did it as not really being a part of the weekend rotation. That was another function. Like Jaden Hill was awesome in the bullpen, but like, he's going to have a different role this year. So we were kind of looking for guys with different roles.
Right. So some of the other guys that stand out, you know, you kind of still have these buckets of, like, you know, guys who are kind of, you know, more known names, although at this point the most known names are on this list, but there, you have those and you kind of have the more developmental guys. But, you know, a couple of guys that stood out to me, one of them actually just got mentioned on the podcast, and that's Julian Bosnick at South Carolina. He's one of the other South Carolina guys we could have put on this list. I'm glad Coach Kingston mentioned him as a member of the rotation. One of the more borderline cases of, has he broken out, has he not broken out, is Court Rodig. He's thrown a lot of innings at Georgia Tech, but you know, he is now being looked to as a guy that the rotation is going to hinge a lot on what he's able to do in 2021. Georgia Tech has a few guys like that are, you know, good stuff. Not, you know, haven't fully proven themselves. You know, Brant Herter is another guy like that. He has a little more track record, I think, than Rodig. But so there's a couple guys there at Georgia Tech. One other is Jack Carey at Duke is interesting. Duke's rotation is a little bit interesting because, A, we're kind of looking for the next Bryce Jarvis. Bryce Jarvis, really nice arm that came into 2020 and just absolutely crushed it in 2020, earned his way into being drafted higher than you would have expected coming into the season. But, you know, between Cooper Stinson is there, Henry Williams is a sophomore they really like, or I guess a second year freshman. But Jack Carey is a guy that when I talked to Coach Pollard earlier this offseason, he really spoke highly of. He's a guy who doubled down on trying to get better in the offseason, spent time at Driveline, which, you know, more and more guys are doing. If it's not Driveline, it's something kind of like Driveline. So that's not all that unique anymore. But a guy whose stuff has taken a jump because he really doubled down on trying to figure out the mechanical piece of it. So he's a guy I'm interested in just because I think we are kind of looking, you know, Duke always pitches well, and sometimes they have guys that make these leaps, and could it be Jack Carey? So I'll be fascinated for that one.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd encourage everyone to check out the list over at baseballamerica.com. You know, it's one of the, when we conceived of doing these top 25 lists throughout the offseason, this is one that I thought of early on, but we really had to wait to see, you know, what kind of information we could get from fall ball to do it. So I'm glad we were able to do it. It's going to end up being the last one of the year. We'll see if we, what our schedule looks like in January, if we're restarting the series then. But if we don't, I'm glad we were able to get this one in. So I would encourage you to check it out. Joe, before we get out of here, I wanted to quickly take a side trip into the college football world for a second. The regular season there ended over the weekend, and the college football bowls were announced. And so every year on Twitter, I've done a poll where I ask which of the first of all, the New Year's Six, the big bowl games, people would most like to see on the diamond this spring, and then the rest of the bowls. So Joe, answer live my poll on the podcast. Which New Year's Six matchup would you like to see on the diamond this spring? I include four because that's all Twitter will allow you to do. We've got Alabama, Notre Dame, got Clemson, Ohio State, Oklahoma, Florida, A&M, UNC. The fifth is Cincinnati and Georgia. And then the sixth is really the right answer because it's Oregon and Iowa State. And if they were able to play that on the diamond, that would mean Iowa State added football. So that's like number one, just because we would love to see the Cyclones. Oh boy. We would love to see the Cyclones get back into the college baseball business, but obviously not an option right now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a good thing. Yeah. So added baseball at the beginning, you said that means Iowa State would have added football. Which for a lot of Iowa State's history, it felt like maybe they hadn't added football.
I'm just doing great here in the state of Iowa right now.
Yeah. Well, the good news is they don't have baseball. So there aren't too many Iowa State fans who will be incensed that you referred to them as the Hawkeyes. I actually like that matchup better if Iowa State doesn't add baseball and they just like have a ragtag, like walk-on tryout. They're like, hey guys, we're going to go play Oregon. We need like 25 guys. So come on down. We're just going to see what we got and going to head up there. So to actually answer your question, so Oklahoma, Florida is one of the options, right?
That's correct.
So I mean, that's the answer there. I think. I mean, it's obviously the number one team in the country in Florida. Spoiler alert, and an Oklahoma team that is getting better. I think is really, really good. Even though they're going to do some retooling in the rotation, like I just really like that group as a talented group there. You know, Texas A&M UNC has its.
The early leader in the poll, and there are more than 200 votes, so it's going to be hard to overturn it, I would guess. And I frankly don't understand it because, yeah, Oklahoma, Florida seems like the answer to me. A&M, UNC, I'd be interested in, but UNC is not – like, it's just hard to know what they are right now.
Yep.
I think A&M has a chance to be pretty good. UNC has the chance, but there's a lot of unknowns there right now, which would make it interesting, but – you know, it's a little more uncertain than the rest of these matchups, I would say.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, that's a good baseball matchup. It's one, especially in 2021, like I don't know that either of those teams are going to be in our preseason top 25. I mean, there's reasons to like them, but you know, there was what's the Alabama matchup?
Notre Dame.
That's intriguing. I kind of like
it
that.
It is. I mean, so you have Alabama, which was last year's like breakout. You know, we were going to see what they could do in SEC play, but there's every reason to think that they'll be better or at least prove that what they were doing last year was for real this year. And then you have Notre Dame, which was another darling team at the start of the season, swept UNC on the last weekend of the year, and then went out and added some intrigue and grad transfers. So, you know, again, they can at least prove that what they were doing last year wasn't a mirage. Nico Cavadas is back in that lineup. They got nice athleticism. I would be very intrigued in how that would turn out. I'd also be intrigued in Clemson and Ohio State, just because Ohio State last year got off to a sluggish start, but you know, they have Seth Lawrence way back. They've got some arms, and you know, I Clemson is always going to hit. They've got some intriguing arms of their own. I think that'd be a fun matchup. Maybe not as fun as Oklahoma and Florida. Maybe it would be funner though, because you know, Florida just, it seems like a runaway freight train potentially. And Oklahoma has a little bit of retooling to do. We've talked about that here on the podcast before about, you know, totally new rotation. What's that going to look like?
Yeah. So I think Florida, Oklahoma is the answer. If you're looking for, you know, you just want big bold face names you can put in lights. Like, I think that's there, but I, you know, if you're really looking for what the most illuminating series would be in 2021, it might be that Alabama Notre Dame series. So that's a good one. Some, you know, you do this poll every year, and sometimes it's like you get one or two. They're like, okay, you know, but then the rest are kind of duds. I feel like you've got a really good batch this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so then we got non-New Year's Six, and this one is hard because, again, only four options, and there are a lot of really good options. But the four that I chose were UCF and BYU. Oh, and don't ask me what any of these bowls are because I don't know. UCF, BYU, Oklahoma State, Miami, Arkansas, TCU, and Ole Miss, Indiana.
Those are good ones too. I would probably go Arkansas, TCU. That seems to be the just the quick snap judgment answer here. Oklahoma State, Miami, also interesting, kind of in the same way that different, but similar to Alabama and Notre Dame, in that we'd learn a lot. I think Oklahoma State, Miami, we'd learn a lot too. Those are you know, two programs that are, you know, have some new guys in big roles, and we're kind of unsure about exactly what we're going to get. And I think that would probably help us learn a lot about those two teams. So I'm going to go with Arkansas, TCU, with Oklahoma State, Miami as a close second.
Yeah, I would definitely sign up for three games of Hogs Frogs. That would be fun, just period. No doubt about it. I think UCF, BYU would be really intriguing. That in UCF, you got a team that started really hot, but has some questions to answer. They lost a few pieces from that team. BYU was really young last year, but highly talented. So I would just be interested in that kind of, you know, intersectional matchup. But yeah, it's hard to go against any of the three, you know, big brand name potential games here in Oklahoma State, Miami, or Ole Miss, Indiana. Hard to go against, you know, them. And again, Hogs Frogs, like, those are two teams that are going to be ranked to start the season. You know, two really great brands, programs, fan bases. That it'd be a fun series, no way around it. A couple that I didn't mention, but we got Liberty against Coastal, Tennessee and West Virginia. I think those two, you know, nice potential as well. Maybe not quite as big as the matchups I did choose, but you know, like I said, it's hard to narrow down the entire bowl slate to just four options, even in a year where there are less bowl games than we're used to.
Tennessee, West Virginia would definitely be an interesting one. I've started doing a little bit of like really early digging on the Big 12 for preview purposes, and you know, I don't think West Virginia's, you know, they're going to be a team I predict towards the bottom of the league, but they've got talent. That team is talented and intriguing. And last year, I know Randy Mazie really liked the young talent they had on that roster, and we just didn't get to see it develop. So that's a team I'm kind of looking for, is to, you know, kind of like in that group, you know, the group that ended up hosting the couple of years leading up, you could kind of see it coming. And I just wonder if maybe that's what we'll see the next couple of years with West Virginia as this group kind of comes together.
Yeah, I think both teams, it's another series. We would learn a lot if they wound up playing. And, you know, I like that they're kind of close to each other geographically. And, you know, I feel like both programs have a chip on their shoulder. You know, West Virginia definitely does. I think that's fair to say that they feel like they're overlooked a lot of times in the Big 12, and maybe nationally as well. And then Tennessee is, you know, they're just trying to come back, you know, get back to where they feel like they should be after, you know, 15 years of not being in Omaha and 14 years of not making the NCAA tournament. So, you know, they're kind of clawing their way back. And, you know, so I just feel like both of those programs play with an edge. And so I think that would make for, you know, a fun series if that were to happen. All right. So that's going to do it for us today on the Baseball America College Podcast. We will be back here next week with a show to wrap up the season. Joe and I are kind of trying to figure out what way we're going to take it. Maybe some New Year's resolutions, maybe some Christmas presents, maybe a little bit of both. We'll see. But we're gonna have some fun with it. I would also say, if you have any questions, it'd be a great time for us to answer them on that show. So feel free to send them to us either via email or on Twitter. And I am at Ted Cahill and Joe is at Joe Healy BA. So we will be back to talk with you guys next week on the Baseball America College Podcast. We want to thank you for listening. Wish you all a happy holiday, and hopefully everyone can have some holiday cheer as we get through Christmas and get into New Year's. And again, before you know it, it'll be the college baseball season as well. So thank you all for listening. Thank you to Mark Kingston for joining us this week on the Baseball America College Podcast. Thank you to Rapsodo for sponsoring it. And for Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll see you next time.